Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Lieutenant General Michael Peterson, U.S. Air Force, Chief of Warfighting Integration, and Chief Information Officer. Also joining us in our conversation is Dave Hathaway, partner in IBM's Defense Industry Practice. General, the Air Force has stealthy, precise weapon systems and the best airmen in the world. And by adding IT to that mix, the service has been able to make its assets more efficient and powerful. To that end, could you elaborate on your warfighter integration vision?
It was during Kosovo, and we knew that we had to roll back the integrated air defense system around Pristina so we could fly our non-stealthy aircraft in and strike the Serbian ground forces. Without a ground force to flush them, that's a difficult task. There was one SA-6 guarding the capital of Pristina. We've surveyed the area now to bring in a surveillance reconnaissance asset to look at those hide sites. One of them has the SA-6 on it. No, the mission is not done. You don't know exactly where that hide site is until you've sent the image back to another computer, stretched it to fit the grid coordinates on a map. Okay, now we do know where it is, but the clock keeps ticking. Now it's time to find out if you have an asset to strike the SA-6 surface-to-air missile battery. Sort through available platforms. Start to do mission planning. Line that strike platform up with the support package. By that, I mean the tankers that will refuel it on the way, the electronic warfare assets that will support it. And to complete that mission, in that instance, took 4.5 hours. And as we like to say, 17 consecutive miracles. Anyone that looked at the details of what we had done, this was 1999 timeframe, that understood information technology would have said, why haven't you modernized? Why haven't you linked these warfighting systems together so that critical pieces of information, once you understand the process, will flow machine to machine? It's not someone shuffling papers. It's knowledge that is fused and put together so a decision maker, a commander, a pilot can make a decision and take action and not pass information around. And that was the genesis of warfighting integration. Today, that same action in Iraq or Afghanistan is down to tens of minutes, certainly less than 30 minutes that we would be able to go strike any what we call time-sensitive target because we've planned for it. So plenty of work left to do to make us more lethal, more effective, and certainly more efficient. The good news is with what industry has been able to offer us, it's quite often more efficient and less costly to pursue the modernized capability than to stick and sustain the legacy systems.
So to what extent does your warfighting integration plan deliver a roadmap to the future and ensure that the right investments are made to optimize decision superiority to the warfighter? And what are some of the key benefits and critical challenges to this implementation?
That is a great question. The key to all of this, and I'm glad you said roadmap, the key to all of this is an architecture, an enterprise architecture. And that starts with, as I said earlier, policies, rules, processes, and eventually it gets down to a roadmap and a technology description of where we need to go so you can make investment decisions. The Air Force started down this architecture journey in earnest about 5 years ago. And at first it was little more than drawings of boxes and linking them together. It was not rich in its description of policy or the rules by which we operate. It has certainly matured. When OMB came to visit 6 months ago and asked about our architecture work, I could point to the work that we had done in 2006 alone. I could tell them how much money we had spent on building out the architecture and then show them definitively that we had been able to make decisions about future systems in terms of retiring them in lieu of new capability, in terms of investment, where for every dollar we had spent on architecture, there was $10 of cost avoidance in the out years. And so the cost avoidance, money that we didn't have but we're going to have to find, ended up over the next 5 years, $77 million that we didn't have to spend those dollars because we'd made an early good decision based on architecture.
Sir, DoD is transforming from platform and organization-centric to a net-centric operation, and the armed services CIOs are providing the leadership to meet this net-centric vision. Would you elaborate on this net-centric vision for the Air Force and what exactly is net-centricity?
The net-centricity, and we throw that term around, everyone wants it to be a technical solution. It's certainly technology underpins it, but it starts with understanding of a process. So if I am a joint force commander, for instance, General Petraeus, he should have access to every single piece of information that we have. He needs a fused, real-time picture of what's happening. He needs to understand the impact of a capability that the Air Force might bring to the fight versus what it would take for other services to create the same effect. Net centricity is exposing that information or that data, allowing it to maneuver the network under a framework or a set of processes that we have prescribed so that that commander has exactly the information he or she requires to get their job and their mission done. And it's not just up the chain. It's down the chain. It's so that the air component and the land component can exchange information seamlessly and in real time without having to go through 16 different translators. So the net centricity comes from understand the process, understand the flow of information, understand the data, and then put the technical rules in place so that information can flow. As simple as, what is the service that you use to send messages across your network? Is that the same message service that another component uses? If it's not, how do we account for that? Do I describe this type of data one way and you describe it another? That's the reason the CIOs of the services are perfectly poised to really lead this effort. Now, I'm not going to name data. I'm going to find that functional expert and build a team around him or her that can identify the data, create the taxonomy, describe the process, and then we'll provide the technical expertise so when it's time to build an application or a service on this broader network, we all can use it and benefit from it.
Last year, the Air Force added cyberspace as a mission area in addition to the traditional air and space operations. What challenges have you faced in creating the Cyber Command and integrating it with existing Air Force operations?
The first challenge is always, so what is that? And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but it is not simply IT networks. It is also the RF spectrum. It is also, in the future, it would include directed energy weapons. Cyberspace is a domain in which we operate. Cyberspace is a man-made environment. So anything in the electromagnetic spectrum in a man-made environment, that would be cyberspace. So the second challenge is our leadership understanding the importance of cyberspace in the future. For us to be able to operate freely in that domain, to know that that domain will always be available for our use, so to operate it, to protect it, defend against attackers. Why would we ever want an adversary to have that same freedom of movement in a similar domain? So to think about ways that we could take that capability away from a potential adversary. And why did we start now? Certainly, the Air Force, all of the services, do a lot of work in the cyberspace domain today. But we do it, for the most part, in functional stovepipes. So we have our intelligence surveillance reconnaissance community that does some work in the cyber domain, but they do it separately. What we really must develop is a professional force that is steeped in all of those elements of the cyberspace mission. And so how do I grow that expert with that breadth of knowledge? Well, it will probably take a decade or more to start to grow. So it's not about Mike Peterson. It's about the captains and the staff sergeants that are out there, as well as our civilians, that we want to bring into this culture and to train them across the breadth of cyberspace missions.
So you mentioned the importance of data before. What is the Air Force's data strategy for the new digital era, and how does the strategy seek to make data identifiable, accessible, and understandable throughout the enterprise?
Our Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary Michael Wynn, brought some great experience from industry with him, and part of that had to do with exposing data and information. Industry viewing information as an asset, as you would any other item on your tally sheet. And it was really his emphasis that got us moving in the direction of our Air Force data strategy. He asked us as a staff to be able to conduct a clean audit where we understood the rules, we could expose the information, and that we could repeat the process time and again. And we're well on our road with the first deliverable of a set of pathfinders that take us on the clean audit. I understood full well that he knew that the department would operate more effectively, both on the warfighting aspect and on a business aspect, if we could discover data, expose data, share data, and we understood when we spoke about data what we were talking about, the taxonomy, the vocabulary. He took us on this journey where each functional community, each mission area, has been charged with the responsibility of understanding their data, understanding the processes through which they employ that data to come up with answers. So it's building communities of interest that would go out and do the definitional work, understand the process so you can map out the data flow, the ontology, and then build a vocabulary. Now that we've done that, the Department of Defense can leverage any work that we've already done. We're leveraging work that the other services have done, and eventually you have this very rich vocabulary, understanding the processes, the ontology, the several seemingly small but very important examples. One I'll quickly highlight. At Patrick Air Force Base, one of our satellite launch facilities near Cape Canaveral, Florida. But at Patrick, before you could launch a satellite, you had to understand that all of the range systems were ready or what the stage of readiness was before we could launch a satellite. And of course, you know what we did. We threw an army of people at it. Instead of going to each of those systems, exposing the data, building a real-time, runtime metadata environment, so you simply go to the website, type in the mission number, and all of the supporting systems on the range that are required to launch that mission number, immediately the database is populated and you get status. But that describes our data strategy. Finding out where the authoritative data is, describing it and making it available for everyone to use.
General, we've used terms such as architecture. We've used terms such as net centricity. I'm going to add one more to the mix here, and that's service-oriented architecture. Now I'm going to try to phrase a question that uses all three of these terms. What role does service-oriented architecture play in making your data strategy as well as your overall net-centric vision a reality?
The importance of a service-oriented architecture is that services, what we used to refer to as embedded applications or capabilities or tools, those services are now able to be shared across the enterprise. So if I built a service that kept track of who is supposed to be on the network and could certify that, yep, it's Mike Peterson on the network, if I built that service, in the past it would be embedded in a system, and only that system could benefit from the service. In a service-oriented architecture, I can build that service, I can publish it, and expose it for everyone's use. Now, that saves, because we all know what service we're going to use, there's built-in interoperability. Because we can all share that service, we don't have to reinvent another service. So a service-oriented architecture allows you to publish a service, share it. Now you are into the issue of identifying which piece of data is authoritative. And because I can always go get it, then I don't have to build data warehouses. Because I know what protocols and services to count on, so now I have interoperability. So the benefits of a service-oriented architecture are huge in terms of access to information, interoperability, and cost of sustainment. It's not really easy. And that's why, as I said, we're undertaking a number of pilots or pathfinders, small steps where we can understand how to expose data, build a metadata environment, build out the communities of interest, working with our acquisition teams, what are those services out there that we think, you know, based on industry advice, are most likely to stand the test of time so we don't have to replace that service in a few years. The other big piece of service-oriented architecture is configuration management, understanding who is providing a service, hosting it on their server or what framework, understanding who the authoritative data sources are and making certain they understand it, and keeping our vendor teams knowledgeable and integrated so that we can continue to build and not repair. We are absolutely excited about service-oriented architecture. It's not necessarily something that you have to take in one entire bite, but I really do envision that in a dozen years or more that it will be much more a pure service-oriented architecture than it is today. But it'll be one bite at a time as we move forward and allow us to spend our dollars more efficiently.
What about the U.S. Air Force's IT innovation? We will ask Lieutenant General Michael Peterson, U.S. Air Force, Chief of Warfighting Integration and Chief Information Officer, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.